what I would like to do in the next 2 days is to deal with some of the fact and fiction associated with child-rearing practices. Today I want to focus on the family unit as a method of child-rearing, and then tomorrow focus upon non-family methods of child-rearing, looking at communes as an example, daycare centers, things of that nature. So I can divide the effort here into two distinct parts. What does the word family mean to you? When that word is mentioned, what is it that comes to mind? Anybody? Mother, father, and children. Anyone else? Relative. Stability. Okay. Would you say that your responses are characteristic of family throughout time? The family as we know it today is largely a nuclear family, which means that it's pretty much functioning as a unit by itself. It doesn't have the old support system that we're familiar with when you look back into history. But the concept family is also quite new. Let me go back into history and kind of give you a sketchy run through that. Those who study child-rearing practices have noted some changes over time. Particularly, there have been 6 different modes of child-rearing that have occurred since the time that we have started to investigate what's happening in child-rearing practices. And it's only since the Industrial Revolution has the family taken on a focus that is similar to what it is today. But prior to the Industrial Revolution, family did not exist as we know it. There are several modes that can be seen through historical perspective. First is what's called infanticidal mode, which deals with antiquity. And people who had children back in the days of antiquity pretty much killed their children because they didn't know what to do with them. And they abused those that they permitted to live. And it was very common to kill children because they didn't have much of an understanding of how to raise them. A second period in time has been classified as abandonment, which is generally associated with a medieval time period. And what we were able to determine here is we had immature parents who accepted a child's right to live, but they gave the child up. They didn't raise the children. They abandoned their children to a wet nurse. They had them shifted to other families as servants as early as age 5, 6, or 7, if they lived that long. They were put in foster families. They were given away to monasteries, nunneries, or they suffered severe emotional neglect. A third stage is what's called ambivalent, which is associated with the Renaissance stage. At this point in time, it was noted that there was a closer relationship that existed between parent and child, but it caused parents to be very confused on what to do. At times, they resorted to a common practice, which was to give their children an excessive amount of enemas, and the reason they did that was to get rid of all these projective evil feelings that resided in children. And this way they could clean them out from all these evils that they possessed. And then they would switch to a kind of behavior that was very loving and caring, and they would flip-flop kind of back and forth. A fourth mode is the intrusive mode, which is characteristic of the 18th century. In this time period, children were viewed as being less possessed by evil spirits. Parents tend to be less abusive to their children. They did not engage in such practices as swaddling. You know what swaddling is? Wrapping kids up in a long bandage so that they could not move their extremities. And they used to do this in ways in which they could play games with children. They'd wrap them up. They would put them behind hot ovens. They would hang them on pegs. They would toss them from one window to another. And the reason they tied these kids up, swaddled them, was to keep them supposedly from pulling their ears off, playing with their genitals, doing other forms of bodily damage. And they'd even prevent them from walking, learning to walk, stopping them from crawling at least. They stopped the common practice of sending their kids out to be servants. They reduced the amount of enemas that were given to children. The 18th century is the first record we have of any massive attempts to engage in toilet training. Now, that's a rather recent phenomenon. We're in the 20th century now. Children also found themselves in a position that their parents were praying for them, and this was relatively new. Discipline changed slightly. It was still abusive, but parents began to prey upon guilt as a method of correcting their children. The 19th century up until the modern day is considered to be a mode of socializing where we attempt to socialize children and to reach adulthood. And our basic view today is that children need constant or continuous guidance and direction in order to make it in society and become civilized. We have some pretty good support for that. If you are familiar with so-called feral children, children raised in the wild by non-humans, wolves in particular. So there's been some classic books written on that. Particularly one that comes to mind is a book written by the French physician Jean Itard, who wrote about a boy that he found in the woods near Paris who was raised by wolves, and whom he named Victor. But Victor had spent too much time with the wolves and could not be changed into a human being. He could not develop human language. He could not learn to eat with our common utensils, and eventually died. He could not make the transition. So he was raised by non-humans. What we're concerned about is that our children are raised in a way in which they take on human characteristics and they act like humans. We also find in the socializing period today that we're getting away from severe beatings of children, severe neglect, even though it's a common concern. And I think the National Institute of Mental Health currently ranks child abuse as the number two mental health problem in the country. So it's still an issue. It hasn't died out completely. But we've made progress. We employ during the socializing mode today covert methods of controlling behavior, manipulation, guilt, and we also see a greater quality in the kind of parental involvement. A new mode that's beginning to appear is that of helping, and that is viewing the child as the center or the focal point of the parental experience. And that view is one in which the child knows what is best for it, and the parents have to respond to the child's needs, particularly in the first 6 years. So now we've gotten into a situation, and we at least see it developing, in which the child determines what the parents will do, and not the other way around. We respond to the needs and the stages that children grow through, and we then do our rearing on that basis. That particular mode
requires an awful lot of parental strength, time, energy, maturity. And I don't think a lot of parents will function in that mode very well, because it is very demanding on individuals. All six modes are observable today. We have made progress in that regard. However, some parents act like psychological fossils, in that they resort back to previous modes and have either gotten into some kind of evolutionary arrest on their own part, and they seem to be fixated at a point and they can't go beyond, don't seem to visualize any way that they can react differently toward their own children. They're somewhat limited in their own, I guess, sense of maturity about how to relate to others, particularly their children. However, the general feeling is that childhood and parenthood is far more humane than it has ever been, even though we recognize we have problems today. Now, I mentioned that the family has not been the same through time. The earliest form of family was tribal, and then we got into the creation of families for economic reasons. That's why you had marriages occurring, some of which, many of which, I must say, were not based upon love or affection. They were based upon economic necessity, and parents determined who was going to marry whom. And out of that marriage, you had the possibility of love developing and affection and things of that nature. But it was for economic reasons that we had marriages taking place. And children are kind of an interesting byproduct of that. It was common for, in an economic marriage, to have both husband and wife working. Economically, they had to. And that's somewhat characteristic today, I might add. But it was also common for such things that if the husband died and he were a craftsman, that the wife would immediately marry the person next in line in the business, the next craftsman who was immediately beneath her husband in that shop or the guild or what have you. And it was a case, again, of economics, not of love or affection. You also have to keep in mind that the changes have taken place in the family relative to sexuality. It was not until the 17th century that the church began to set down some doctrines about how you are to behave as parents toward children. It was common practice up until the 17th century to have everybody sleeping in the same bed. We didn't have separate beds for children. They slept with their parents. And as a result, they oftentimes suffocated intentionally or unintentionally. And the way the church found out about what was going on was that in the confessionals, parents would talk about accidental suffocation or intentional suffocation. And then the church began to react toward this, that this was killing people. So then we had a phase where children were not permitted to sleep with their parents. They were also involved in sexual intercourse along with their parents, and this was viewed as a very common kind of thing, and there were no taboos on this kind of activity. In fact, the language of the day was very coarse, and it was common street language, and nobody batted an eye about the use of swear words and profanity with children, because everybody was talking the same way, and it was not viewed as a bad thing for young children to experience. So the church has been instrumental in changing some of our thinking about what kinds of things should young, impressionable minds experience. And our general notion is that even today, that it's not good for young children to hear certain things or to observe certain things, because it will have some kind of traumatic impact on them for the rest of their life. Okay, I want to stop here for a minute and see if you have any reactions to what I've said thus far, and then I'll go on.
The theater that you were referring to, is that true of all cultures? Somehow I guess in the reading about the Hindu people, you feel like maybe they had stronger family ties back in the theater.
They may have, but it may have been pretty much viewed as a communal or tribal responsibility. And I think it would be cross-cultural. Early practice was to allow children to find someone they liked to be with, regardless if it was you or your natural parents or someone else. Children got the opportunity to decide who to be with, and it was kind of a feeling that we're all kind of responsible in a sense, even though there wasn't much responsibility shown. That children could, in fact, side up to someone whom they respected or had some kind of affection for. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't a feeling of security needed, because when there was a threat to individuals, the families did unite for that purpose, for protection and security. And you would do that also in a tribal lifestyle or communal lifestyle. But children were not that valuable because we did away with them with regularity. The horror stories are just unbelievable. Oh, no. The problem is people following the guidelines. It's hard, very hard to. But it's very hard to overcome tradition. Keep in mind that not until we had the printing press could you mass produce material for people to read. It was all by word of mouth. And not everybody heard the word. But we have seen greater maturity on the part of adults, realizing that in a natural kind of way, that you can't continue to abuse children in the process. I didn't like being abused, and therefore they would begin to change their thinking about what are correct procedures to follow. Okay, because of a short period of longevity. You know, you'd have to go back prior to what we would classify historically as a medieval time period. I would think you would have to fit that in there, yes. The church was aware of some things. The church's priests were aware, for example, in the early Catholic Church that kids were being, young children, infants were being dropped in latrines because they could hear them screaming. That was a common way of doing it. But then the church began to take some stands on this practice of infanticide and saying you just can't abuse your offspring that way. No. No. That's right. You would find probably a different methods employed based upon, I suspect, more what was needed economically to survive. That the economic situation had a lot to do with the practice involved in raising children. Well, the last government statistic I read for a family of four in our society to have a moderate standard of living was $18,662 a year. But our continued research in the area indicates to us that people are giving more thought, and they're giving more thought for a variety of reasons. They're finding, our research is supporting the fact that if you have less children, you're going to have higher quality children. Well, it's not possible. It is possible. Firstborns are the highest intelligence. As you go down a family of six kids, invariably the last one is going to be the lowest of intelligence. There are exceptions. Yes. But look what genetic counseling is doing. That wasn't available 100 years ago. And now parents, prospective parents, have an opportunity to find out whether or not they're going to produce a child that's going to have some kind of genetic abnormality, congenital birth defect, retardation. I don't know. I think it's going to go on. I think that as society gets to be more complex and the world population continues to increase, there's going to be more thought. But then you've
they
yeah, I think they
very,
have.
Very little, because some governments won't allow it. Well, India does, and they have signboards all over the country saying a small family is a happy family.
Well, that could be, but there's still their religion and their way of life and the family depends on a large family.
It's an economic reason. But it's... There's some belief that in our society you can view the family as ghetto. That's an interesting kind of notion. We have people trapped, and they can't get away from the family. They can't function independently. We can't get rid of them. They're trapped for some time. That's an interesting notion. Look how long we keep kids, you know, tied to us. Long time. And that's rather recent history that we do this kind of thing. And we do it because nurturing and so forth and raising them to be so-called civilized contributors to the larger society, we're really trapped. It's a long period for us. It's a long period for them. Well, let me go on with some American kind of data. Jerome Kagan, who is at Harvard, is a very prominent individual in the area of human growth and development, and he has studied not only trends in our country, but elsewhere. And he makes the following notes about child-raising practices. The 1940s and 50s in our society was largely a time of leaving children in undisciplined and unconstrained state. And he believes that children were handed power that they couldn't deal with. That we kind of took our responsibilities, parents abdicated those and gave them to children. They didn't want this power, they didn't need it, they couldn't handle it. And the result was a willful, domineering, spoiled, abominable kids running around. 1940s and 50s. What we're currently experiencing is a mode in which we want children to hurry up to adulthood, and we kind of push them to get there. There is little evidence to indicate that children are growing up faster physically, but they're under pressure to grow up faster psychologically and socially. And I think that's pretty true, that we do put kids under a lot of pressure. I'm 40 years of age. I don't think that's very old, but I've seen a change since my adolescence in which there's certainly a lot of parental organized activities for kids that are pushing them socially. I look at organized sports, in which parents are living out wishes through their children. They're getting them into organized all kinds of activities, soccer, football, you name it. And there's a lot of pressure there. And orthopedic surgeons as a group aren't very happy with what they're having to deal with in the way of serious bone injuries on kids. But then we put them into other kinds of context too, in which we want them to hurry up to adulthood. In the there's our David Elkind is another psychologist, and he believes that that we have parent-child contracts, that we contract with each other, in which we have very implicit agreements about mutual obligations. And he notes three basic contracts. The first is freedom and responsibility that exists between parent and child. Then a second kind is loyalty and commitment. And a third kind is achievement and support. And he believes that's a kind of a current cycle that we're in, where we're interested in our children achieving, and we support them in any way that we can to get them to achieve. That reflects nicely on us as parents. It does them some good also, and the fact that it's ego building for them when they get recognition for achievement. We do it through schools, other kinds of organizations in which we're a very achievement-oriented kind of society, and we support and encourage our children to get in these kinds of things. Kagan states that when you look at parents and try to make some judgment about their quality as parents, he says, the evaluation of a parent as hostile or accepting cannot be answered by observing the parent's behavior, for neither love nor rejection is a fixed quality of behavior. Like pleasure, pain, or beauty, it is in the mind of the beholder. Parental love is a belief held by the child, not a set of actions by a parent. And we tend to look at parents and make judgments about them as being loving parents or accepting parents, or the other side of the scale, they're not very good parents. But what you really have to look at is the parents from the child's eye.
I have a friend who is very gruff with his little son. Every time he says anything, he doesn't ever say please or thank you, but just commands him to do things. And the son absolutely adores him. He trots behind him like a little puppy and just loves him to pieces. I could never quite figure that out, because I've never thought that would be a... I never thought that kind of parent was a really good parent. Mm-hmm. But like you say, it's in the mind of the child, and apparently in the mind of that child, he just worships his father.
Mm-hmm.
But also children are very forgiving, even children that have been beaten by their parents. If they're separated from their parents for a while, they're very happy to see their parents again.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons, I think, is why in child abuse cases, rarely will you find children testifying against their parents, no matter how abusive. They're dealing with an unknown. They don't know what's going to happen to them, but they're very familiar with what will happen to them at home, even though once they get out of the court, you know, it's liable to start over again.
This makes them feel insecure, and that's why they kind of cling to what they
have. Even though we would say, it's terrible that those kids would like that, or the parents would treat them that way. And parents find that their kids will not testify against them. Well, I guess I would justify it by the fact that the child, knowing no other kind of relationship and seeing only what's available to them at their own home situation, has no other basis for making a judgment, and therefore could not, in a sense, experience the truth in a way that would say to them, do you want to try living in a different home? Because that's an unknown. That's venturing out into foreign territory. That's far worse mentally than knowing what I'm growing up with.
And that can be that way everywhere out there.
Possibly.
And that security of them, family.
They have no experience base beyond their family.
And he's abusive.
Oh, we do that. Yeah, I know we do that. We do it through the courts. Because we base that on the fact that from our frame of reference and our perspective, that is not good modeling, it's not good parenthood, it's bad practice, it's unhealthy, and the child is going to go up and repeat that cycle. And that's what's known about severe child abuse people, that they don't know how to relate in any other way, and it's very hard to break that cycle, and therefore we say, well, you can't continue with that practice.
So really, you can't say that that the only way you can judge parents is through a child. That statement really is kind of a false statement as far as I'm concerned. You really can't judge where somebody is being really a good parent by the child itself. The child's mind.
It's hard for us to think that way. I would agree with you.
That's
very hard.
Kagan who said that.
Yeah, and Kagan said it. You know, it's just like looking at some of Jackson Pollock's work and say, you know, it's garbage. Other people look at the same thing and say, yeah, you know, that's really neat. It's the same painting. And it's the way you look at it. We have some interesting notions about the fact that if in order for parents, in order for children to grow up to be good, upstanding citizens, that their home life early in the formative years has to be that kind of situation. That if you raise children in a context in which you would say there are horrendous conditions, that these kids aren't going to make it. There's some interesting research to indicate now that children who are raised by parents who we would classify as unfit for parenthood, be they schizophrenic, for example, or abusers in other ways, don't know how to relate to children. Some interesting things are coming out of the research that there is an element of children in families of that type that almost defy explanation about how they survive under these kind of extreme, horrendous conditions. They come out smelling like a rose, and their parents do in fact not promote that same kind of behavior within them. Let me give you some examples of that. Okay. There is a Danish psychiatrist by the name of Zornof Mednick. He has been studying children of schizophrenic mothers since the early 1960s, so it's about 18 years now. And he ventured into this so-called risk research. It's called risk research because they're dealing with children who are classified as risks. He did so because he ventured into this because schizophrenia is such a widespread and serious disease, and children of schizophrenics have a much higher than average risk of developing the disorder, 12 to 14% as compared to 1 or 2% for the general population. In rare instances in which both parents are schizophrenics, their children's risk runs as high as 35 to 45%. Great interest has developed in studying the 88% who survive a parental upbringing in schizophrenic conditions. Now he's finding that 88% of them do not manifest schizophrenic tendencies, even though they're raised under those conditions. He's been following now since the early 60s.
So the kids are like in their
20s? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How old are
the 20s? Yes, some of them would be in their 20s, maybe approaching 30.
So does it take into account the
loss of I don't know that through my reading at this point when the parents develop that. But 88% clean health. That's interesting. Now, what's fascinating about it is how can you can get that high an incidence of clean health raised under conditions which are considered to be not very sound. One of our own researchers in this area is Norman Garmetzi. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota. He is equally interested in these so-called super kids, or kids who are placed in these highly vulnerable situations. He makes the comment, they know how to make something out of very little, and they bounce back. It's the recovery phenomenon after stress that's so characteristic of them. They just have a tough bite on life. What we are finding is that we have been hooked into the medical model for so long, which is basically taking a pathological situation and tracing it back, and what's the cause of this kind of situation. More emphasis is being placed upon, let's find out how people turn out well. Let's trace some situations and find out what causes them to defy the odds. What have they got going for them that allows them to do this kind of thing? And that's a different approach rather than trying to work backwards and unravel the mystery as to how somebody got into problems. Garmetzi indicates that much can be learned by studying the invulnerable children, as he calls them, as from studying those who break down. When it can be determined what is the strength of the invulnerable children, perhaps it can then be used in a preventive fashion with others. In other words, how can we benefit by studying how they survive? These invulnerable children, according to Garmetzi, work well, play well, love well, and expect well in the face of deprivation. They know how to handle that situation. There is a psychiatrist in St. Louis at Washington University named James Anthony, and he describes these types of individuals as those who seem not only to be immune to pathological influences in the environment, but they almost thrive on them. They benefit by that experience. The invulnerable children studied thus far share the following traits. First, socially, they seem exceptionally at ease, and they make other people feel comfortable too. They never lack friends and have at least one close friend. They are well-liked by their fellow students, and they're coming out of terrible conditions. Secondly, they know how to attract and use the support of adults. They approach rather than avoid adults, and they don't smother you as overdependent kids will, but act in socially appropriate ways. Third, despite their difficulties, they actively try to master their environment and have a sense of their own power. They try to counter what they're experiencing. Fourth, they think for themselves and develop a high degree of autonomy early in life. The invulnerable create a private space somewhere in their environment. And many of these kids who are being studied carve out for themselves a space, whether it's at their home or some other place, that they can, they can retreat to. And in a psychological sense, create a little world of their own that's very secure and comfortable for them. It's their own environmental space, and they resort to that when things really get bad. Fifth, they are an achieving group and generally do well at most of the things they undertake. Some become exceptionally creative and original. Anthony, who I referred to earlier, believes the very act of creation, such as painting, writing, composing, etc., is what saves them. That they know how to escape, and they do so in a very appropriate way. They will resort to creative and original kinds of activities. The early research that's done at this point points to three shared characteristics of the so-called invulnerables. First, They must have a good relationship with at least one adult, particularly in the first few years of life. And very likely the first year. I think I kind of repeated myself there. Anthony believes the psychologically invulnerable child obtains warm, satisfying one-to-one relationships to set him off in life. And that occurs early in the first year. That there is a time period there that's very healthy. Secondly, children may need challenges in order to become invulnerables. These super kids have not been overprotected. Low-risk conditions may create false expectations that child is invulnerable, but he is invulnerable only in the sense that he has never been tested or tried in the fire of experience. James Anthony also states, I tend to think a great deal should be left to the children and to foster the idea that it is up to them and that they must be the masters of their own fate. We, the parents, will always be around when the children really need us, but the really hard battles need to be fought alone. This may sound like a tough philosophy for child raising, but we are talking about producing a relatively invulnerable child to live in a relatively tough world. And thirdly, there is a limit to the number and severity of stresses that can be imposed on a child at any time, for each stress multiplies the effects of the others. Now, the research being done in London at the London Institute of Psychiatry relative to children, there are Michael Rutter has identified six separate risk factors that are strongly related to psychiatric disorder in 10-year-olds. And the six are severe marital discord, low social status, overcrowding in the home, psychiatric disorder in the mother, a criminal father, and admission into foster care or institutions. Rutter's research shows that children with just one risk factor were no more likely to have psychiatric disorders than children with none. He notes that when any two factors occur together, the risk goes up fourfold. With yet more concurrent stresses, the risk goes up several times further still. The most resilient child could be overwhelmed in this way. So if you can reduce the risk factors, you can, in fact, allow a child to cope better with a tendency to ultimately engage in psychiatric disorder. It may be very desirable to eliminate just one stress in a child's life, even if other stresses remain, for this could give him enough strength to master the rest of his problems. One thing that keeps popping up here through the research is that at least they're finding with these so-called super kids, they take the challenge very well to try to master their conditions and do something about it. They're not sitting back waiting for help, seeking compassion and sympathy from others, but they're trying to master their plight. And that's not characteristic of a lot of kids. Let me go on here and end up. Unfortunately, the researchers who have been studying vulnerable and invulnerable children have not yet discovered at what stage of development intervention would be most effective, or whether there is a point of no return beyond which no intervention will help. Nor do they know whether a child who appears invulnerable at age 12 will remain so during adolescence and adult life. The maximum period of risk for mental breakdown is between ages 15 and 45. Norman Garmetsi notes that some people view the inconclusive data on invulnerables to endorse the joy through suffering theme. And others claim the data show that it doesn't matter what you do to children. He detests both viewpoints. It's dangerous, in a sense, to publish research like this because parents get the notion you can do anything you want with kids and they're going to come out all right. Well, that isn't true. And that was like publishing the premature reports on the Head Start programs. Once those studies were out, the money began to dry up because the government's view was, or at least I should say the legislators' view in Washington, D.C. was, oh, this is money down the tube. And why should we spend money on Head Start? Because, look, by the end of third grade, you can't tell the difference between Head Start kids and non-Head Start. They all look alike. So there's a danger here.
Well, there were the thing of it was that really disturbed me. There were so many Head Start programs that were really successful that gave the child a half a year. To me, how they progressed educationally wasn't the big important thing. But I think each year in a child's life is an important year. And if attending a Head Start program makes that child happier and more satisfied, stimulated, encouraged, even if it doesn't make any difference on how well they learn later on, it's doing something for them as people. To think that when you're four, that year isn't as important as any as when you're 10, mm-hmm. I think is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid the people in Washington didn't see that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a number of very, very successful Head Start programs, and one of the big advantages was what it did for the adults in that area, because you had to get adults working in the program from the area where the children came. And that had a tremendous influence on the homes. I know we trained Head Start teachers in our lab school. And I remember one mother said, "Don't you ever walk them?" She had never seen anyone dealing with children without beating them when they didn't do what they were supposed to. So they learned a new way of dealing with their children.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, this information can get in, as it does with government people, gets in the wrong hands, and you read into that exactly what you want to, and then you make decisions. And that's dangerous. When Arthur Jensen published his theory in 1969, February issue of the Harvard Educational Review, boy, that was just ammunition for some people. Absolutely. An unproven theory. It took up the whole Harvard Educational Review, which is unusual in itself. And what, you know what I'm talking about? Oh, he published a theory that blacks are genetically inferior to whites by 15 IQ points on the average. And it's due to genetic factors and not environmental. Well, it has Harvard's label on it. When that came out, people bought that as evidence for good solid support for racism. You know, and boy, a lot of people have made hay out of that thing. It's an unproven theory. And Jensen has rightly so suffered a good inquisition on how he could come up with that theory. Because then, if you don't accept it as theory and you accept it as fact, as some people have, then you can treat blacks differently because you're dealing with genetically inferior people. And you don't need to put money into programs for blacks because it's not going to pay off.
Getting back to what Doris said about Head Start, I sometimes feel that the government likes to use things that can be measured. In other words, these students, the student success could be measured on a third grade level, but you can't measure what you were talking about in terms of testing or...
No.
Maybe perhaps report, but nothing that could be measured to say how much we were testing.
Or to test what it did for the homes in that area. There's no way. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's sort of ignoring the maturation factor, where these children are not ready to learn these things until... Mm-hmm. They're introduced to them later on in life. Mm-hmm. When they're mature enough, they learn with joy. And there are some things in the preschool area in Head Start, you don't teach them to read there. There's no attempt to teach them to read in Head Start. Why should they learn to read at the age of four? Many times if you try, it will give them a sort of a mental block, so when they're ready to learn, they have an attitude against the whole process of reading, because they've tried to force them to read before they are maturationally read.
Well, I should run over here. I did not get to present information about some myths and fact associated with the role of fathers, what research is showing in that regard. So I think I'll put that before, I'll pick up with that tomorrow and then get into non-family kinds of methods of child rearing and present some information about what research shows in that area about how successful are communes and other forms of child rearing practices. Any other comments or questions before we break here?
When you were talking about the children who had been in homes with schizophrenia, was that the mother or the father or either?
Either one.
Could that make a difference? Which parent had the mental problem?
Yes. I would offhand say that if it's a mother, it's worse. If it's a father, it's less of a problem. Because he's just not around.